responsively. My dear Dhruva, at the age of only 5 years, you were very grievously afflicted by the words of your mother's co-wife. And you very boldly gave up the protection of your mother and went to the forest to engage in the yogic process for realization of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Already achieved the topmost position in all the three worlds. That was Prabhupada's translation, and this is Prabhupada's purport. Manu was very proud that Dhruva Maharaj was one of the descendants of his family, because at the age of only 5 years, Dhruva began meditating upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and within 6 months, he was able to see the Supreme Lord face to face. Factually, Dhruva Maharaj is the glory of the Manu dynasty, or the human family. The human family begins from Manu. The Sanskrit word for man is Manushya, which means descendant of Manu. Not only is Dhruva Maharaj the glory of the family of the Svayambhuva Manu, but he is the glory of the entire human society. Because Dhruva Maharaj had already surrendered to the Supreme Godhead, he was especially requested not to do anything unbefitting a surrendered soul. Om Agyanati Mirandasya Garananjana Salakaya Chaksurun Vilitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manovistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kramayam Tadati Svapatantikam. As Prabhupada mentions, Dhruva has the highest position in the material world, even though this was not his original intention exactly. I mean, he wanted to be the king, but he didn't aspire for such a high position as he ultimately attained. Dhruva is the deity of the pole star. He is considered to be, therefore, in the highest position in the material world in one sense. But his desire was not like this. He had some great material desire. But by the grace of the Lord, he was able to overcome this desire. And his fame in the Vedic history is that he is one of the devotees, one of the classes of men who approaches Krishna. There are four classes, and one of those classes is one who approaches for material advancement. And such a person can get the mercy of the Lord and become a pure devotee, and the material desires are eradicated by the mercy of the Lord. Of course, Dhruva Maharaj was not an ordinary person. But even if someone, Prabhupada uses the word induced a lot, can be induced to undertake some form of devotional service, even if it's contaminated with some desire to become opulent or to have a position in the material world. If such a person is in association with a pure devotee or is taking instructions from one who is transparently trying to pass on the message of Krishna without any ulterior motives, then these impurities can be eradicated, and such a person like Dhruva Maharaj can obtain perfection. And even if Krishna desires attain material opulences according to one's desire, or even beyond one's desire, as was the case with Dhruva. So he wasn't at all ordinary. His austerities were so great that it's said that the planet was slightly adjusted in its orbit. It was pushed down, so to speak, by the weight of Dhruva standing on one leg. So that's not an ordinary person. So this is an instance of someone who has a very powerful position or a very strong relationship with Krishna, who by some way, for some reason or other, has become a victim of material enjoyment. And later on, by his austerity, by his great devotion, it comes out that he's actually a very great devotee, a very great soul, whose background might not have been known. So Krishna often puts his devotees into this kind of forgetful position, as he does with Arjuna again and again and again, to teach the world how impurities can be eradicated and how the Supreme Lord can be pleased. Sanatana Goswami and other Goswamis are glorified in our literature as being great devotees, And they also, before, for example, Rupa and Sanatana, they were engaged in government service. And even though Sanatana, for example, a great devotee, he was also mentioned that Chaitanya Chaitamrita as one of the Manjaris, I think Rati Manjari or Lati Manjari, maybe both. Very highly elevated person, incarnation of a gopi. And yet, he, when he met Lord Chaitanya, confessed that he was very fallen. He said that he had become victimized, in fact, by material enjoyment, by associating with meat-eaters and enjoyers. So this was his confession. But he was raised to the point of pure devotional service, or we should say that pure devotional service was remanifested by his association with Lord Chaitanya, and he became one of the great leaders of our sampradaya, writing many, many books, taking instruction from Lord Chaitanya at Varanasi for a long time, and becoming very much spiritually empowered to carry forth the mission of Lord Chaitanya. Now when that Dhruva was, he was a Kshatriya, and sometimes the qualities of a Kshatriya are hard for us to understand. They have a certain sense of pride, and the whole Kurukshetra war was one of the reasons you could say that it was fought was because of the pride of the Kshatriyas. When the Pandavas returned from exile, they were told by the Kuru dynasty that they couldn't have anything. They wanted just a little kingdom, because Kshatriyas want to have a kingdom. That's their nature, they're administrative, so they have to have something to rule over. So they wanted just a little village or a few villages, but they were denied that. They were told they couldn't have enough land to stand on. They couldn't have even the pinpoint, and the same amount of land to stand on as a pinpoint would make. So Lord Krishna, being their intimate friend and understanding the nature of a Kshatriya, thought this was unjust. And this was one of the reasons why this great battle was fought, that the desires of the Kshatriya could be fulfilled, that they were being unjustly treated. And of course, they inherited the whole kingdom. So Dhruva was also in this mentality. He was, even though he was very, very young, Kshatriyas are very strong, and they don't feel pains like ordinary people do. Therefore, they're able to engage in battle and come back all bruised and scarred and limbs cut and so on, and they're heroes. In fact, if they come back without blood on their bodies, they're considered to be cowards. So it's hard to understand the nature of a Kshatriya sometimes, because they're very, very powerful and very brave and very... not immune, but they're almost immune to pain as we understand it. So when Dhruva was denied the kingdom, first of all, he was denied to sit on his father's lap. His stepmother thought this was an insult. So in royal families, there are a lot of competition. There's a lot of competition, and it's not uncommon in history that people in royal families will sometimes kill their own brothers or mothers or fathers or sons, daughters, and so on. There was the story that Prabhupada used to narrate about Aurangzeb and Shah Jahan. Shah Jahan was a Muslim ruler around about the 16th century, and he had a son named Aurangzeb. Aurangzeb was a very vicious sort of ruler, kind of like King Venu. Anyway, he had some brothers. He had three brothers. So he killed his brothers. Especially he was wanting to kill the older brother so he could get the throne, so he could attain the throne. And then he didn't kill his father, Shah Jahan, but he imprisoned him and acceded to the throne. So he was very, very cruel. And the way Prabhupada narrated the story, he started out by telling that Aurangzeb was walking along the roadside with his young son, and he was telling his young son that he should follow moral principles, he should be a good boy, he shouldn't get into trouble. And his son objected. He said, how can you tell me to behave myself when you killed all your brothers and imprisoned your own father? Anyway, the story was that his father was imprisoned, and then a Bengali playwright wrote a play called Shah Jahan, and it was this whole story about the killing of the brothers of Aurangzeb and imprisoning Shah Jahan and so on. And Shah Jahan was the one who, if I'm not mistaken, built the Taj Mahal and to the memory of his deceased wife. So he was also a very famous emperor, a very qualified architect and so on. So there was a window on the side of his cell, and he used to gaze out this window, and he could see the Agra Fort, his palace and his fort and his armies and everything, and he could also see the Taj Mahal, but he couldn't leave. So he was constantly lamenting. He could see out the window his wonderful creations. his armies, his fort, but he could not go out. And his son was the despot who was abusing and ruling the kingdom after having killed his own sons. So he led a very tortured life. And the play that was written about this whole incident was called Shah Jahan. So someone objected that the dramatist had written about Aurangzeb mostly, and about his exploits and his intrigues and his killings and his conquests and so on. So why was the play called Shah Jahan? He was just in jail all the time. So the answer Prabhupada gave was that the real story, the essence of the story, was the tortured mind of Shah Jahan, how he was sitting in the cell recounting all these things that happened one after the other. So it was kind of an entry into the tortured mind of the former ruler whose son had usurped the kingdom and so on. So very internal psychological analysis of his tortured mind. And also because it was so wise and perceptive as far as the way royal families sometimes rule and kill indiscriminately or even discriminately, intentionally, to gain the throne, it was considered by Prabhupada important enough to refer to in some lectures. So in the royal court, Dhruva Maharaj was disturbed to the point where he felt he couldn't tolerate not being able to sit on the lap of his father. So he went to his real mother. The kings had many wives those days, Suniti, and poured out his grief on her. So also, being part of a Kshatriya family, she advised him, knowing that he was a very powerful person, even at a young age, that you should go to the forest to find the Supreme Lord, and in this way you will achieve your desires. So he thought this was very important and followed this instruction to the letter, underwent great austerities. And finally Narada Muni came to advise him how to act in a spiritual way, how to become purified from his material desires. So this is the mark of a person who is not at all ordinary. And in the instance where he later came back and took over and relieved his father of the kingdom and then became king, there was a battle with the Yakshas described in the previous chapter. Yaksha means, one of the definitions of Yaksha is someone who protects material enjoyment, or a protector of material enjoyment, the protector of riches. So that's the nature of such persons. And because his brother was killed, because one of the Yakshas killed the brother of Dhruva Maharaj, again his Kshatriya spirit welled up and he sought revenge. Of course, it's not ordinary revenge. Sometimes anger manifests in the body or mind of a devotee, and if enacted in the spiritual way, this is not considered to be impure. This was the case with Arjuna. He was very saintly. He didn't want to fight. He was ready to give up everything. But at the bidding of the Lord, he was informed that he could use his prowess, he could use his ability and his anger in the service of the Lord to protect religious principles. And Krishna himself, of course, comes for that reason sometimes. Prityanaya sadhunam vinachaya chaduskritam, to annihilate the duskritinas, requires force. Or even in the ordinary mundane sense, the police force or the rulers, they have to use force to protect people, innocent people, against the rogues and rascals. When King Venu was ruling, after King Venu, there was no ruler. And there was a hiatus, there was a period of time between him and Maharaj Prithu where there was no ruling head, and the rogues and rascals, as Prabhupada calls them, and plunderers were so active that a great cloud of smoke arose above the kingdom, just like the breath of a great dragon. And there was dust everywhere because they were running hither and thither, as he says, plundering and stealing things. I guess you could compare this to the smoke above the Los Angeles or any of the big cities where there's a lot of freeways and automobiles. It's like the dragon breathing its smoke. And when you come in on the plane, you can't even see Los Angeles most of the time. In the riot, it was like that, wasn't there? There were so many fires that you actually could not see the city at all. So this riot's actually going on all the time, but in more subtle ways. The material world is such that there is a constant plundering and constant lying going on. So the whole atmosphere, whether you can see it in the form of a cloud or whether it's just the sound waves going through the atmosphere, they're full of lying. So the whole atmosphere becomes polluted. And there's cheating when there's no proper head of government, no proper devotee who is actually in charge to see that things are properly run. So Dhruva exercised some of his kshatriya prowess, some of his powers and his mentality to gain revenge on those who were not following religious principles. And here now he's being instructed to, as the, of course we read this, the great illusions were created by the yakshas, and he was killing so many and so many that Manu, his grandfather, said that this is enough. You now some innocent people are being killed, so your kshatriya anger should abate, and you should understand that actually there are no such things as friends and enemies. As he begins to discourse, the Supreme Lord is equal to everyone, and so on. So to pacify him and remind him, he was actually, as Prabhupada mentions, eradicating his last tinge of false ambition. Those are the words Prabhupada uses, eradicating the last tinge of false ambition. So just as the disciple or the student looks to the spiritual mentor, look within me, tell me what's wrong with me, eradicate whatever needs to be eradicated. Sanatana Goswami's first question to Lord Chaitanya was, who am I? In a very humble way, asking, because it's difficult sometimes to look within oneself and find out all the seeds of desire, all the partially manifested desires and dreams and material desires. So this was his reasoning. It's also explained in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, it's from Chaitanya Chaitamrita, that the Bhakti Lata Bija, or the creeper that grows to ultimately reach the spiritual sky, the Bhakti Lata Bija, Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Bija, is in need of constant watering and cultivation. Because as it grows, at the same time as it grows, there are weeds or unwanted desires or unwanted behavior that also grows up around these creepers. And sometimes these weeds grow up around the creeper and so much intertwining it that it appears that it's all the same. And it's difficult for the conditioned soul then to know what the difference is between the two. So Lord Chaitanya describes that one has to be very discriminating to be able to distinguish the difference between the devotional creeper and the weeds that may embrace that creeper and surround it and cut them away. So there's two processes, the watering or cultivating process, hearing, chanting, worshiping the deity, and then there's the process of cutting away the weeds. Or this is also likened to jettisoning our material attachments one after the other so that the Bhakti Lata Bija can grow. So there are different types of these unwanted behaviors that occur in the minds of the conditioned souls. One is diplomatic behavior, one is animal killing, one is mundane profiteering, one is mundane importance, and another is mundane adoration. I don't know exactly what the distinction is between those two, but they're mentioned. Those specific things are mentioned, five things. So Dhruva Maharaj, although he was becoming more and more and more pure, Manu detected that there was a little bit of ambition left, or a sense of mundane importance, a sense of wanting adoration. So he instructs him to please stop your anger. Anger is useful to a certain point and then it can become destructive. And then later on in this chapter he goes on to say about how anger itself is very destructive, and it can be actually the most destructive thing in spiritual life. See if I can find that passage. He instructs him. This is in the 31st verse. My dear king, he's addressing Dhruva, just consider what I have said to you, which will act as a medicinal treatment upon disease. Control your anger, for anger is the foremost enemy on the path of spiritual realization. I wish all good fortune for you. Please follow my instruction. And of course, sometimes this anger, it just seems to manifest without reason, although it's generally described as a result of sense gratification not being properly achievable in Bhagavad Gita. But it's also one of the constant threats to spiritual life. Lust, anger, and greed. Akam, krodh, lobh, madya, mada. What is it? Matsarya? Moha, madhyacharya, moha, illusion. So it's one of the constant six things that imprison the living entity, is this anger. And we understand that there are three levels of consciousness: thinking, feeling, and willing. So anger starts within the mind. It starts as a thought, and then one feels like one wants to do something, and then if it's manifested fully, then one acts on the anger. So in the material sense, anger is very debilitating, because as it's explained in Bhagavad Gita, from anger comes loss of memory. So memory, or perfect memory, at least in its pure form, is pure Krishna consciousness. And loss of memory is lack of Krishna consciousness. We were discussing this the other day. When one attains the spiritual body, memory is completely perfect. One remembers all one's past lives, every little detail. And anger, therefore, is a kind of opposite side of this. It's the thing that takes away memory. So Manu is explaining how dangerous it is to give vent to anger. The idea is, if the mind is controlled, as soon as there is a thought of anger, then at that point it should be dispelled, rather than letting it lead to its natural consequences, which are feeling angry and then being overcome by anger and then acting upon that anger. So many things have been lost, so many kingdoms have been lost, so many lives have been lost, because in one moment of anger, someone expressed that anger. So it's also said in the beginning of the Upadeshamrita, Vacho Vegam, Manasa Krodha Vegam, Jiva Vegam, Udara Pasta Vegam. That one should control, it specifically mentioned the actions of anger. Vacho Vegam, Manasa Krodha Vegam. It doesn't say the thoughts of anger or the feelings of anger, but the actions of anger. And it's very difficult in Kali Yuga, especially, to control anger completely, because it certainly arises within the mind. But if one can control the actions of anger, then at least anger can be controlled. Because if the action isn't carried out, then gradually it goes away. Prabhupada gives the example of scratching an itch. It itches, and if you can somehow control the action of not scratching it, it'll go away. But if you succumb to the action of the scratching process, then the itching increases. So anger is like that. It sort of feeds on itself. So in the purport to that verse, Prabhupada says, but anger is such that if one increases it, it increases unlimitedly. In order that Dhruva Maharaja's kingly anger not exceed the limit, Manu was kind enough to check his grandson, etc. Then he goes on in another place to say, by constantly hearing about devotional service, one can check the force of anger, which is detrimental to the process of devotional service. And further, Dhruva Maharaja's becoming angry with the miscreants was quite appropriate. He goes on to say how initially this anger was appropriate, and that one shouldn't deny it. If a devotee is threatened, if one's body is threatened, then these are some of the instances one can use anger, if there's a burning of the house, stealing, and so on. So it's not that it doesn't exist, but it has to be very carefully controlled. And then in the next verse, he says, a person who desires liberation from this material world should not fall under the control of anger, because when bewildered by anger, one becomes a source of dread for all others. In the purport, Prabhupada writes, but a saintly person never becomes angry, even if there is great provocation. And there was a story of, I think it was Narada Muni, and the serpent. The serpent, somehow, by the grace of Narada Muni, became a devotee. This story is narrated, I think, in one of these chapters. And he, or somewhere, is it in the Bhagavatam or the Chaitanya Chaitanya? I don't remember, but it's in one of the purports. Prabhupada narrates that this snake, he's a cobra, had become a devotee. So he was advised by Narada Muni, don't bite anybody, because cobras are very deadly. And as a Vaishnava, he didn't want to bite anybody, and he was advised not to do it. But then people took advantage of him. They were throwing rocks at him, they were stepping on him, and he couldn't fight back. Nobody likes snakes anyway. So he went to Narada Muni and he said, what can I do? I'm tolerating all these insults, and I can't fight back. So Narada Muni said, well, one thing you should do is you should raise your self up and show your hood, the big cobra hood, but never bite anybody. And this way you will frighten them, but they will never attack you. So in other words, you don't actually get so angry that you bite them. You just manifest a little anger up to a certain point, and then but you control it very, very carefully. So this is the meaning of controlling of the mind, Vacho Vegam, Manasa Krodha Vegam, Jiva. One has to control the tongue, one has to control the mind, the actions of anger, and the urges of the tongue, belly, and genitals. And by doing this, Rupa Goswami says one becomes qualified to gain disciples all over the world. So this is the most important thing, gaining control. Even by by practicing celibacy, even without real spiritual understanding, one becomes very powerful. Prabhupada used to say that Gandhi became very powerful, even politically, because he was so strictly controlling his sense of his sexual desire. He was celibate for a long time. And then Prabhupada writes in the purport, I think this is the last verse in the chapter, he says, next to the last verse, our behavior should be such that no one should become angry and thereby commit a wrong to individuals, families, or society. So we can see that even from the material sense, that the sense of danger is very destructive. It can create great havoc everywhere. And we see that the whole world kind of rests on this very, it's kind of hanging by a very fine hair. There's not a big, big war. Of course, there's many, many wars. But just by a little insult against false pride, some politician somewhere becomes angry, becomes upset, forms a big faction, and then his whole country becomes a raid against another country, and then there's a huge conflagration, big world wars, one after the other after the other, just due to this one thing, this lack of control of anger. So Dhruva, one of the great qualities of Dhruva Maharaj is his submissiveness. First of all, he's submissive to his mother, he's submissive to Narada Muni, he's submissive to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he's submissive to Manu, he's submissive to all his superiors. And in one sense, we consider all Vaishnavas our superiors, especially those who are, they've been devotees longer than we are. We try to get the mercy from them, take instruction from them. Even sometimes it may mean reversing our ordinary course of events or course of thoughts, but at least we try to approach someone we consider more advanced than we are, and ask them, am I doing the right thing? Am I going in the right direction? Is this right? Is that right? Even in the material world, I think the businessmen there learn when they buy something, they should get three different estimates of the cost. So, and spiritually, whenever we do something, if we're intelligent, we consult with advanced devotees and ask them, are we doing the right thing? So even though he was very into his kshatriya mode, being very angry, killing one yaksha after the other, when Manu came to instruct him, he was very submissive. He immediately changed his course of action and took instruction very nicely. So one is very great and yet very dedicated. Being a very dedicated follower, Prabhupada once said, one who wants fame the most, one who wants fame the least, he said, one who wants fame the least gets it the most. So all the great kshatriyas, the great kings, the great rulers, and all of the great demigods, at least when they're in trouble, if no other time, they're very, very submissive. They take orders from the Supreme Lord. They take orders from their superiors and act according to their instruction. So this is one of the great qualities of a Vaishnava. And of course, the real riches in life are not to gain kingdoms, not to gain wealth, but the real richness is devotional service. And Lord Chaitanya taught there were three great riches in the world: Krishna, devotional service to Krishna, and love of Krishna. And other than this, there are no riches. And anything else may appear to be riches, it is actually abject poverty. It's not really riches. A devotee has the vision that nothing in this material world is attractive. It's all very deceitfully alluring. That's a healthy kind of negative view of the world. But he knows where real riches lie, and therefore he's able to see everything in the proper perspective. And because Krishna is so kind, even if one gives up everything, or he takes everything away, yasyaham anugranami harishe tadanam shanai, sometimes he takes everything away, the result is the devotee is very, very happy. He's happy with nothing, just like Sanatana's touchstone was out in the refuse. He thought it was very insignificant that you could get whatever you wished. So love of God is so powerful that once one has that, and this is what's happened with Dhruva, once he was able to face the Supreme Lord, he realized, as he mentions in his famous verse, that he was looking in the wrong way for material enjoyment. Or sometimes it's said, broken pieces of glass, and the greatest jewel came before him. So if Krishna so desires, one can divest oneself of material opulences, or maybe Krishna takes them away, but then real riches come. And even if he gets some material riches or material benediction, that's considered unimportant or insignificant. Sanatana Goswami, as we recall, he got this nice blanket. He'd become a mendicant to go and meet Lord Chaitanya at Varanasi. But he had this, and he noticed Lord Chaitanya kept looking at this opulent blanket that he had. So when he went to bathe, he saw Bengali mendicant was wearing an old quilt, and he begged him to trade it for his new blanket. And when he came back with the torn quilt, Lord Chaitanya was very, very, very happy. Here was a person who was a minister, he was very, very wealthy, he was a scholar, he knew many different languages, he was adored in society. And when he saw that Lord Chaitanya didn't like the nice blanket, he went back to him. Lord Chaitanya was very, very pleased. And this, again, was like one of his last... Lord Chaitanya actually said, this was your last attachment to the material world. And he was very pleased then to instruct him. So there are so many little last attachments one may have. But by seeking out the help of superior Vaishnavas, we can locate them and properly confront